and please help me to welcome our speaker tonight. His name is Billy H., and he is from the Design for Living Group in Neptune, New Jersey.
Hey, guys, I'm Billy. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the group for having me, Lauren for asking me, my friend Kevin for taking the long ride out here with me, and I want to thank the God of my understanding for the opportunities that I'm given on a daily basis, because by no means should I stand here today, you know. So it really is truly an honor and a privilege that I get to do this, and I'm glad you guys say the set-aside prayer. My only hope in ever doing this is that enough of me is moved out of the way so that I could transmit something to you. I'm also happy that I didn't know that this was a group anniversary prior to 4 minutes before the meeting, because I don't know about anybody else here, but we can put a little pressure on ourselves and we can overthink anything. So I was under the understanding that it was just a celebration meeting, so I thought that there'd be people celebrating, and this is your group anniversary, so congratulations on 13 years, and it's an honor that I get to do it. So, you know, hopefully through all this, if I can get out of the way, everybody will get fed here. And if you don't get fed, I'm told that there's cake afterwards, so I got it afterwards. But really, that is why, you know, why I do this. I carry the message because it feeds my spirit and because it can help the next person, you know. And if you get help, that's awesome. So my date of sobriety is October 8th, 2009. You know, that is a date that was given to me. It wasn't a date that that I chose, or, you know, it's not by any virtue that I, you know, stand here sober today. You know, it's really, it is what that placard we see in many meetings is. It really is but for the grace of God that I stand here. You know, that date of separation for me, you know, was given to me because my intent was to drink until the bitter end. You know, there was absolutely no way, shape, matter, or form that I would be a sober human being. I didn't want to. I knew that I needed to, but I knew that it was impossible. So the fact that I was, you know, essentially struck sober, you know, is a miracle, and it is like our literature calls an act of providence. And I hope and I pray that I never forget that's why I stand here today, because the minute my ego shows up and starts telling me that I did this, that's the minute that I'm headed for trouble. And I think that I have enough good people in my life today that I've given spiritual consent to, you know, that will tell me that truth when that day, or if that day comes. You know, I try to stay in the center of this so that the mind doesn't show up and do that, but, you know, you guys know how this works. That is possible. So, I have a home group. It is Designed for Living. It is not my home group in name only. I am an active participant there, which means that I am there every single week. It means that I attend the business meetings, although sometimes begrudgingly. If you're ever down the Jersey Shore on a Sunday night, stop in and visit our group. The meeting's at 7 p.m. in Neptune. It is a big book study meeting, and generally speaking, we get a crowd of about 200 to 300 people, really, depending on the time of year. And it's really a powerful experience. I mean, you know, I'm sure you get many speakers here that will stand up here and say that their home group is the best home group in AA, and they're wrong, because my home group is the best home group in AA. No, it's the best home group in AA for me, absolutely. And the reason being is when I walk in there, I just feel the spirit. And I know that the spirit lives within every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but for whatever reason, I can feel it when I walk in there. And when I walk in there, I see men and women sitting with one another, working through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in our book. And there's just such great power in that. You know, and I love my home group. I have a service commitment in that home group. So, you know, for whatever reason, they thought it was a good idea to trust me with their money. And had they known me about 10 years ago, they wouldn't think it was a good idea. I've gotten better with money over the years. But the funny thing is that today I am kind of better with their money than I am with my money. And it kind of teaches me responsibility. And there's like an equanimity to all of this stuff. It kind of comes together. So I am the group's treasurer. And I don't know. I mean, it's pretty amazing the life Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, you know, again, despite myself in a lot of ways. So you know, I didn't set out to become an alcoholic. You know, I didn't set out to burn my life to the ground time after time. I didn't set out to destroy the lives of everyone around me time after time. You know, when I was growing up, you know, I had dreams, I had hopes. You know, teachers would ask, what do you want to be when you grow up? I had actually wanted to be a police officer, which, you know, that absolutely never came to be. I had many interactions with them. You know, what I can say about me growing up was that there was just something within me that just wasn't right. A friend of mine from the Pennsylvania area, and I don't know that he's still around, but he used to talk about how, like, you know, when you watch children, they'll be looking for a toy, and they'll be like searching through their toy box for that toy. And it's like, you never find that toy. And I was like that kid that I was always seeking something, and I could never find it. It was like the itch I couldn't scratch, you know, and it was just this constant state of uncomfortability. And, you know, I wouldn't have called it a spiritual malady back then. I wouldn't have called it that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But some of my earliest recollections are thoughts and feelings of just, you know, bitter resentment, anger, fear, you know, just always consumed with what other people thought of me. You know, just always this drive and this need to, like, fit in somehow, some way, to do whatever I had to gain your approval. You know, and that was from, like, the age of six. Like, my earliest memories, my first, you know, early memory would be of, like, bitter resentment. You know, my father and mother were married for 10 years. They had me, and 6 months later, they got a divorce, right? So, you know, my father was in my life, and he played as active a role as he possibly could. And when I was about 6 years old, he had remarried, and he had had my half-sister, and then he eventually moved to Florida. And I remember just being so, so angry and just having these feelings of abandonment, you know, which are probably all normal to a degree, but they were just so consuming, you know, and then just on and on, you know. So my mother, she did the best she could to kind of raise me on a nurse's salary on her own. We moved around a lot. I lived in 22 homes by the time I graduated high school. I had gone to 8 different school systems. I was always the new kid, you know, and I don't think that makes me an alcoholic in any way. It definitely kind of just creates the environment, the condition, right, the uncomfortability. Like, everybody's always looking at me because I'm the new guy. And I'm always seeking approval, you know. So I do what kids do. I get involved in sports. I do okay in sports. I love when people clap for me. I hope you guys all clap at the end of the meeting. It's really important. It does me very well. You know, and so, you know, sports were good. I played baseball. You hit a home run. Everybody stands up and cheers. It's great, you know. But it just wasn't quite enough, you know. And I just kept seeking, and I kept seeking. And, you know, as a young man, then it was women. And, my first experience that I can remember with alcohol was at the age of 12. As I had said, my mother was a nurse. She worked a lot of doubles. She had gone to work, and, you know, but prior to going to work, you know, she had pointed out to me the little hutch in the corner with the childproof locks on it, and she said, "You're not to go in there. I'm working a double." And this may have not even actually happened. This is what I remember, but. And, you know, you don't tell someone like me, like, don't do it. You know, if you tell me don't do it, it's an open invitation to do it. So, you know, sure enough, you know, I know she's going to be working for the next, you know, 16 hours or whatever. And, you know, I make my way into that liquor cabinet, and there's, you know, there's tall bottles, short bottles, fat bottles, skinny bottles, brown bottles, clear bottles, every kind of bottle you can think of. So I just start, like, pulling them out, bringing them into the kitchen. I'm mixing stuff together, as you know, later as a trained alcoholic. I know you don't mix together. I know there was Sambuca, because I remember it smelled like licorice. There was brandy. I remember she liked to drink brandy. There was probably some wine, some vodka, and I'm just mixing all this stuff together in a blender, because I know there's strawberry ice cream in the freezer, and I'm going to make an alcoholic milkshake. Like, this is what's going on for me at the age of 12, right? So I do this, and I don't know. I don't know that I experienced the ease and comfort, that effect produced by alcohol at that time. In hindsight, looking back, I think I did, because I do remember that day, and I remember it was a warm day, and I was a skateboarder at the time, and I remember just kind of feeling like carefree, just like skating around the neighborhood, not worrying about, you know, what kids are going to beat me up today or whatever else. And, but it didn't resonate. It didn't really leave its imprint on me. I continue on through high school, and I'm playing sports, and, you know, I really didn't have any other drinking experiences until I turned 17. So, it's my junior year in high school. I'm on the basketball team. I make friends with this kid, Joe. He has me over his house for New Year's Eve. His mother goes out. His sister is supposed to watch us. She falls asleep. He goes into the liquor cabinet. He says, "Hey, do you want to have a drink?" I'm like, okay, this is what people are supposed to do, right? It's New Year's Eve. You drink on New Year's Eve. I'm 17 years old. He pulls out a clear bottle. And there's like these little golden flecks like floating around in it. So it looks attractive in some way. And I'm like, sure, let's drink, you know, and he pours this glass. And, I don't know. I just remember it, you know, and I don't know. My memory can be sketchy at times. And this is going back to like 1995, right? And I remember it. Like I remember the tingling on my lips when the glass touched my lips. I remember like the warmth in my mouth. I remember like how when it was like going down, like you kind of feel the warmth going down. When it got to the bottom, it was like, whew, like there was just this feeling like I felt the warmth in my stomach, but it was something that was deeper. It was almost on a soul level. It just kind of overtook me, and I felt like that feeling of ease and comfort. It was just like, wow. And he had said to me, he's like, "Hey, Steve's having a party up the road. Do you want to go to Steve's house?" Now, if he had asked me that 3 hours earlier, I would be like, well, I don't know, like Steve's house, there's probably people there, I might have to talk, there's probably women, like that's a lot of pressure, I don't know if I can do this. And I'm like, sure, let's go to Steve's house. You know, like that was it was a no-brainer, let's do it. And it was on. And I can tell you from that point on, the progression was very rapid with me, right? So that was halfway through my junior year of high school. I was in my first detox 1 month after I graduated high school. Right? And I had thought that the problem was purely physical. If I could just be physically separated from alcohol at that first detox, everything would be okay. And nothing was further from the truth. And I would run the gamut for years and years after that, you know, separation physically. I didn't realize what I was up against. You know, I knew that this thing was physical. I didn't know it in the words that I know it today. But I didn't understand the mental obsession. I didn't understand that my mind would always bring me back to that first drink. That my mind, it can only see what it does for me. It doesn't see what it does to me, right? I can only see that ease and comfort. I can't see the fact that it's going to just destroy everyone around me. And, you know, what happens is over and over the years, just the wreckage that we cause. You know, my mother, she was probably a classic enabler, you know, and I just remember time after time, you know, coming home, being in another jackpot and her saying to me, "Billy, why do you keep doing this to yourself?" You know, and I would just look at her and I would say, "I don't know. I don't know, Mom, but I promise I'm never going to do it again." And I, you know, I absolutely meant it. I did not want to hurt that woman. I loved her dearly, but over and over and over again, I would hurt her. Over and over again, I would pick up that first drink, and over again, I would be on a spree that would end where it ended. So, my mother ended up getting sick. She was diagnosed with cancer, and I wanted more than anything to be a good son for her. You know, I had recognized that she had sacrificed everything for me growing up, that she just did her very best to be a good mother. And she was. She instilled in me some values that, you know, that I absolutely, that are essential in the man that I am today. I did not want to hurt her. I wanted to be there for her. You know, and she was diagnosed with cancer, and we were at the hospital, and, you know, and they basically gave her like 2 months to live. The cancer had spread all throughout her body, and they said, look, you know, there's nothing that we can do at this point. So, you know, I was going to be a good son. I was going to be there for her. If you asked me, I would absolutely tell you what a good son I was. I would tell you, listen, Mom's in the hospital. She's not doing well. I'm staying with her every single night. I don't leave the hospital. I sleep in a cot in her room. All truth. What I didn't tell you was that because of the life that I lived, I had destroyed us financially. So we had no place to live. So I absolutely had to stay at the hospital with her. She could not even go and die in her own home because she no longer had a home to live in. She had to be in hospice in the hospital. Like, that's, you know, that's the kind of alcoholic that I am. And I didn't want to do that to her. I absolutely didn't want to do that to her. So, you know, coming up to her death, there was a lot of fear. You know, how am I going to live without my mother? All the stuff that's probably natural. All that I did the entire time that I was in that hospital was I would wait for her to sleep. I would leave the hospital and I would go and I would get my next drink, right? I would just bring it back to the hospital. I would split it up into little, you know, Gatorade bottles, put it all over the hospital room, hidden from the nurses and everything else, and I would drink because I was just so consumed with fear and I was just so driven by that physical craving for alcohol that I couldn't do anything else. So, you know, Mom, you know, on the last day, they kind of knew it was coming. The nurse had said to me, it's not going to be long now. You know, stuff was going on physically. They knew that she was passing soon. So at her last breath, I just went up to her and I said, Mom, I'm going to see you soon. You know, and she let go and I let go. And at that point, it was my mission to leave this earth. Now, I had pretty much been doing that in every way possible up to that point, but now it was going to be a concerted effort. I was going to die, and I was going to die by alcohol. You know, I heard it somewhere. Suicide by alcohol is kind of like being kicked to death by rabbits. It's probably not the most efficient way to go. And that's not to make light of, you know, someone dying by suicide in any way. But you know, it's just a tedious process. It's just like boom, 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 boom. You know, and it's painful and it's uncomfortable and it's lengthy. And that's what I was going to do. Not my best decision. So what ended up happening was physically alcohol was taking its toll on me. I mean, at that point, my mother died. I think I was about 28 years old. I didn't know it at the time because I was so trapped in this delusion that I just couldn't see the truth of anything. I would look in the mirror and I thought I looked fantastic. I thought that I should be on the cover of GQ. The truth of the matter was I was 280 pounds. My skin was yellow. My eyes were yellow. There were days I couldn't get my shoes on because my ankles were yellow. I was missing a large portion of my teeth. It was just a, you know, not a vision for you. We'll just say that. So, you know, but this is what was necessary. I needed to be brought to that jumping off place, right? And I don't know that everybody has to be brought there in that manner that I was. You know, but we all have to reach that spot where it's just enough is enough, right? So it wasn't at that point for me. I needed to go on further. So as, you know, as said in our book, it says the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured for 2 more years. So for 2 more years, I continued on and I was drinking around the clock. Like I rarely drew a sober breath. I love the line in the book. I was seldom mildly intoxicated. I was never mildly intoxicated. I was always just annihilated. The fact that I would get behind the wheel of a car day after day after day just blows my mind. The fact that I didn't kill myself or somebody else is the proof of God in my life time and time again. So, you know, finally things are happening to me physically. I'm getting colds that I just can't get rid of. Something's going on. I don't know what it's about. I finally go to the doctor. You know, the doctor's running tests on me. He's kind of like looking me up and down, and I don't know why he's looking me up and down the way he is. And he's like, do you drink? And I'm like, you know, I give him the standard answer. Yeah, I drink a little bit, you know, here and there. You know, meanwhile, out in my car, there is a big handle bottle of the cheapest vodka you could possibly find underneath the seat. And he's like, well, listen, like your eyes are yellow, your skin is yellow, like you got some stuff going on. I'm going to run some tests and see how your liver is doing because it's probably not good. And, you know, long story short, when the results come back, he tells me, and this is at the age of, I don't know, 29 or so, he says, you have the liver of a 70-year-old. You're going to need a liver transplant, you know, if you're to live. And nobody is going to give you a healthy liver, you know, living the way you're living. So, you know, this is pretty earth-shattering news. You know, for the problem drinker, for the moderate drinker, like, this would be news enough that I can say, you know what, I'm going to put it down. And absolutely the thought was there. I need to stop drinking, you know. But not right now. Like, I just kind of need to consider all my options here. I need to weigh things out. I got that bottle of warm vodka under the seat of the car. We don't want that to go to waste. Just going to have a couple drinks. And then tomorrow will be the day that we make our start, right? And you guys know how all that goes. So, you know, because what happens is I pick up that drink, you know, and then it's just, it goes where it goes. You know, it stops when it stops. I have no power, choice, or control. And you know, in the end, the way I was stopped over and over again was by way of hospital bed. I would wake up in the hospital. I started to really look forward to the hospital experiences because I would get free TV. And a TV at the time, the electric was usually off. There usually wasn't too much food around the house. So I was getting three meals a day. I would usually stay in the hospital for about 7 days. They would drain all the fluid out of me. It was just end-stage alcoholism is really, really ugly. You know, and I'm sure there are people here that have seen it. It's just not a pretty thing. But again, it was what was necessary for me. So I'm hospitalized about seven times in a seven-month period. And I'm just suffering from all the complications of liver failure. You know, and again, like, I don't really see the problem in its full scope. And, you know, all through my life and all through my alcoholic career, I feel like there were whispers from God. There were these experiences that were, like, kind of moving me in a direction. And I just kind of discounted them and ignored them. And sometimes he has to shout. And what happened was, you know, October 8th in 2009, I came to in a hospital in, I think it's northern New Jersey. It wasn't a unique experience. What had happened was I had one of these bleeds in my GI tract. I almost bled out. I had fallen out somewhere, and the ambulance brought me to the hospital, and I came to 8 days later, and they had told me what happened. And I would love to tell you that at that point right there, and I know the grace of God had entered into my life, but the obsession was still very powerful. 'Cause my thought was, when am I going to get out of here? I really need a drink. Like, that's, you know, and that's madness. And fortunately, by God's grace, I had been in a coma for 8 days, so I couldn't physically even walk to get out of the hospital. So I had to stay there until I could walk again. And then I had to stay there and recuperate. You know, at that point in my life, I hadn't been employed, you know, for probably, I don't know, I'd say about 9 months. Any family that I had, you know, my father had been in my life again for a number of years. He wanted nothing to do with me, you know, because I had just caused so much harm. And so there was a girl that I was dating at the time, and she was pretty much done with me, but her cousin was an ER nurse and let her know that I was in the hospital. So she showed up at the hospital, and when I came out of it, she had came in and she had visited me, and she had said, you know, I talked with the nurses and the doctors, and they say, like, medically, there is absolutely no reason that you should be alive. God has a plan for you, you know. And I don't know, something about that statement just kind of just, like, cracked me open, and a shift began to happen. And I remember that night in the hospital, I prayed for the first time in a long time, and I prayed honestly, and I wish I could remember the words exactly, but I can tell you that the place that I was in, I didn't want to die, you know, and that's pretty crazy because 8 days, 9 days before, that was all I wanted. All I really wanted was to die, and now confronted with the idea of death, I wanted to live. There was something within me. There was a spirit within me that wanted to live. And, you know, that's God's grace. And I prayed that night, and I just asked for help because I really didn't know how to live. I just, you know, plain fact was I sucked at life in every way, you know, and I just didn't know how to draw a sober breath. And, you know, what had happened was just a series of events. You know, my father eventually came to the hospital. I had spent 30 days there, and he told me I needed to stay there and that he would let me live with him. At that point, I had been homeless, and he had said, you know, look, you need to stay in the hospital here. We're going to let you come live in our home. You know, and he made clear that he did not want me to live in his home. Very clear. And I think it was something to the effect of, they told me that you're going to die on the streets because at this point it's November in the condition that you're in. So we're going to let you live in our home, but there are going to be certain rules. And first, you're going to have to stay here until you physically recover. The social worker is going to set you up with a rehab because clearly you have something going on because you continually do this to yourself over and over again. So maybe rehab is the best bet. And hopefully it's going to be like a long-term, like one of those five-year program type deals. That was his little, you know, pipe dream. And, you know, he said, and then when you complete that five-year program, you're going to get set up with a psychiatrist and you're going to go to those AA meetings. And, you know, at that point, you know, the only thing I could get was like 14 days in a rehab. He was very, very much let down. I was quite disappointed too, because I was still terribly offended by what he had said to me. Because at the end of that little plan, he said, and then you're going to get some money and you're going to get out of our house because you're 31 years old and you don't belong living at home with dad, you know. And how dare he speak to me like that after everything I had been through? You know, like that was my thinking at the time, you know, so entitled, you know, and what I had put that man through over the years, you know. I mean, thank God for this process and the fact that I've been able to set that right and we have a relationship today. You know, so again, I thought that my bottom was significant enough that I would not need to do anything else, right? That pain in and of itself was enough to keep me away from a drink. And, you know, not by any doing of my own, I was brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God that I was brought here somewhat of an empty vessel. I wasn't filled with ideas about what was here. You know, I had stayed away from you people for as long as possible. I had in my mind what AA was, and I wasn't going to go there. You told me about it in detox in 1997. I was not going to AA because it was like a room, and there was like chairs, and they were in a circle, and there was like mainly men over 60, probably most of them balding, complaining about the misery of their lives because of the fact that they can't drink, complaining about their wives and whatever else. And that's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was, and I wasn't going to go there because that would make me want to drink. That was why I stayed away from these rooms for so many years. And I'm kind of happy that I did, because when I came here, you know, for whatever reason, that preconceived notion had been knocked out of me, you know, and I think that's just because of brokenness. And I showed up here with some desperation, with some willingness, and trusted servants were put in my life that, you know, that really just put me on a path that goes somewhere. You know, my first home group, you know, they were not like stepologists or anything like that. They were not beating me in the head with the big book. Alcoholics Anonymous met me where I was at. They just said to me, hey, you need to join a home group. You need to get a sponsor and you need to get active. Hey, we have a commitment tomorrow night. You want to come out with us? I didn't have anything going on. There wasn't a lot of people wanting to hang out with me. So I jumped in the car with these older men and we went to this commitment up in North Jersey and I listened to them give their pitches. And you know, and that's what I did with these guys. And, you know, they said, you need to get a sponsor. And there was one younger man in the group. And, you know, there was just kind of something about him. Like, there was kind of like an energy and there was just a way about him that just kind of my spirit was attracted to his, you know. And he wasn't sober a long time. He basically was sober about 4 years at the time. And he had had an experience through our work and he was awake and he knew that in order to stay sober, he would have to help another alcoholic, you know, and he was trying to help me. And he sat down with me and he read me that book. And I'm like, why are you reading to me? Why can't I read? Like, I'm not a kid. Like, I was just such a whiny baby. And, he's like, listen, you're just going to listen to me because you don't know anything. And, you know, I just thank God that he gave me his time. You know, he met me every Tuesday night before the home group. And, you know, when we got to that third step, you know, we got on our knees and we took that third step and he handed me a like this thing with all these columns. And he said, you're going to write your inventory. And I'm like, whoa, I'm not like a column guy. Like, I don't really like organization. I like chaos. And he was just very patient. He said, okay. Just do what you want. So I used that, you know, fourth step for a bookmark in my book, which was like holding up my bed. And like, you know, it kind of just sat there for a period of time. And I went to meetings and I was just kind of polling the people to see what the better approach would be. And finally, I heard someone say, hey, why don't you write your life story? So, you know, the inner entrepreneur in me is like, this seems like a pretty good idea. Like, I got a pretty good story. Maybe I could sell a few books. Like, maybe I'll do it this way. And, you know, my sponsor, good sponsorship, is cunning, baffling, and powerful. He says to me, okay, if you insist on doing it this way, do it this way. But what I want you to do is in that story of yours, I want you to just identify some of the people that you're angry with, you know, some of these things that you've held on to for a long time. You know, I want you to look at certain things about those resentments. I want you to look at what you're afraid of, you know, and I mean, if you asked me at the time, it would have been like heights, snakes, and spiders, you know, and a number of years since, I really see how fear is that corrosive thread. But at the time, that was what I was able to come up with. And, you know, he said, take a look at your relationships, right? Your conduct in sex relations and, you know, look at the harms that you caused to people. So in that, you know, quote, autobiographical type thing was sort of the deal that we do today, you know, and I think it was enough to affect the change within me. And I did it as honestly as I could at the time. And I shared it with him. And, you know, relief is a dangerous thing. I began to get relief. I did my fifth step. We were on a retreat. We were down the beach. I was very shot out at the time. I was probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 months sober. I sit there with him. I share this with him. He says, take your hour. I'm sitting there on the beach and I'm like looking around. I'm like waiting for like God to literally speak to me in some way through one of his creatures. A bird flies by. I think it should probably sing to me. It doesn't. The ocean does not part in any way. But what did happen was, again, I got some relief. And as I said, again, that can be dangerous. So, you know, what ended up happening was I kind of got stagnant at that point. And there was this one part of the fifth step process that at the very end, he said something to me that I was just blown away by. He's like, are you holding anything back? And I was like, how does he know? So, like, I now know that they teach you that in sponsorship school, but at the time, I was like, this guy really, like, knows his stuff. So, I absolutely lied to him, and I had to, because I thought it would cause harm, and I read somewhere in the book, like, about saving your own skin, blah, blah, blah. So what had happened was, as I was working with this man, he had a nice young lady that was living with him. She was kind of like his daughter-in-law. She was sober a number of years. She seemed to be attracted to me. I was not getting any younger, right? It was time, and I was better because I had now done a fifth step. And, you know, somebody had said to me, like, no new relationships within the first year. I thought that was ridiculous, and I really thought that was, like, for... you know, just for like the amateurs in recovery, right? That was not a suggestion for me. Like I had done my fifth step in 4 months. Like I'm well on the path. It's time for me to find her. So as I said, you know, her was his, you know, kind of like daughter-in-law. She had broken up with his stepson, you know, and they had 3 kids together. And I just thought it was a great idea to get involved with her. And, he somehow saw this was going on, and he said to me, look, if you do this, I can't sponsor you anymore. And I was like, no, nothing's going on. We're just friends. And he's like, okay, whatever. And then he ended up firing me because I was, you know, I was just full of it. So, which I thought was okay because I was at that point where I was in the advanced school of recovery and sponsorship goes away at a certain point. And what I didn't know at that time was I was getting sick. You know, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because really nothing had changed. All that I had was a little bit of awareness. I didn't have much God in my life. Not much work had been done in 6 and 7. I hadn't made any amends, and I was out causing harm. You know, so what do you think was going to happen? Well, fortunately for me, despite myself, yet again, God's grace shows up, and it shows up in another trusted servant, a young man that I had developed a relationship with who had relapsed and had come back, and he had really just been thrown into this work and got active and got lit up and was on fire. And something within me spoke and said, you need to do this. And, you know, at that point, I kind of got plugged in again, and I got connected with a sponsor, and I began to thoroughly go through the 12 steps and to just follow directions without question at that point. And I'd love to say that that was, you know, the end of the story, and it's all been lollipops and rainbows since, but... you know, it definitely is not that, because what ends up happening is, you know, I begin to work with this new sponsor, you know, and we go right from scratch, you know, and I make that decision in 3, you know, I already am very clear on what alcoholism is, you know, I've reviewed my history, I am convinced of my need for God. I make that decision. I begin to take the action of writing inventory. I write a thorough inventory under his direction, the way the book outlines. I share an honest fifth step with him. I get clear on my defects of character, and I begin to try to live differently. I go out and I start making those amends. I make that amends to that first sponsor, and it was a very powerful experience. The long and short of it was, right after that situation had happened, under the direction of an old timer, I had approached my then ex-sponsor and said, "Hey, I'm sorry." And he graciously accepted my apology. Later, having gone through the work, I approached him, I made an appointment with him, I put on a tie, I took him to lunch, I sat down with him, and I was real clear on the harm I had caused, and we had a conversation, and I gave him the opportunity to let me know how my actions affected him, and I asked him, "What can I do to make this right?" He looked me in the eyes and he said, "Look, I had always hoped that you would come here and do this. You just made it right." And the way it turns out, unfortunately for him, was that man relapsed, and I was able to be the hand of AA for him when he came back. So you really never know how this thing is going to work out. So, what ended up happening was I got to that point where I was living in 10, 11, and 12. And, that can be boring and just repetitive if you're not really, having a 10-step practice where it's just like a complaining session with your sponsor. So what had happened was my life began to look good on paper. I began to get the things. I had gotten into a new relationship. I had gotten a new car. I had my own place. I had some money in the bank. I had begun a new career. The things that I thought were really important and defined me began to take place and appear in my life. And, like I had said, the ego can reemerge, and I begin to kind of take credit, and I don't really need to live by these spiritual principles. And now the girlfriend, the relationship is kind of going sideways, and I'm doing a 10th step on it, what I think a 10th step is, and that's me complaining about her, not really looking at my mistakes in any way, shape, or form, not seeking God in any way. And I get tired of telling my sponsor about it because I know he's tired of hearing about it. So now I'm no longer talking to anybody about it. My meditation practice consists of, I read a book that says daily meditation, right? I read it, and if you ask me 3 minutes later what it says, I have no idea. I can't even tell you what it says. There is no quiet time. There is no relationship with God in that respect. I'm praying, and I'm praying often, and I'm praying, "Give me, give me, give me," right? Never use me, use me, use me, just give me. And what do you think happens? It begins to unravel, and that was my experience, and I think it's necessary. I think for me, I needed to experience these things because it's in the mistakes that I grow, and it's not in me doing well in life that I seek God. It's when things are not going well that I really begin to become dependent on Him. If I'm managing my life well, why would I need to seek that power? And what I've learned, through my experience with my current sponsor, and Jimmy has been my sponsor for a number of years now, is that I need to seek all the time, because this is about, this is just about God dependence. The one thing he said to me when we first sat down, after he told me how screwed I am, was that he's going to take my hand and put it in God's hand. He's going to help plug me into the juice, and he's going to, if I give him spiritual consent, he's going to walk shoulder to shoulder with me, and he's going to tell me the truth when I get off the beam, and that's what he's done for a number of years now. And I can tell you that I do have, a prayer life today, because that was one of the things he had asked me when I first started working with him. What's your prayer life like? What's your meditation life look like? Right? If that relationship with God is the most important relationship you have, and you can seem to only make 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes at night, doesn't seem too important, right? So, that relationship is important to me, because when that relationship is right, all other relationships are right. So, so when I had first started working with him, I had, the relationship had gone sideways, it was over. I was beginning to do what I do best, right? Because when something's missing, I need to go out and find it. So I begin doing what I do. I need to get in another relationship. And he's like, listen, like, if you're going to continue to do this, I can't work with you because that's like your primary purpose right now. So you need to stop doing that. So I actually did, because I really at that point was convinced of the fact that I would die an alcoholic death if I did not live by spiritual principles. He said, stop looking for her. When you stop looking, she'll probably find you. So what had happened was a friend of mine, we decided to start a meeting on Friday night, local to us, right? So it was him and I and a couple other people, and I was booking speakers, and the speakers were coming in, you know, and I was pretty OCD about it, booking like months and months in advance. So the week before, we had alternated woman, man every week. So the Monday before, the woman calls me and she says, look, the kids are sick. I can't make it on Friday. I'm really sorry, blah, blah, blah. So I reach out to a friend of mine who he had, you know, primarily a solid network of women. He sent out a group text. That group text went out to, who would later become my wife. I just spoiled the whole story. Sorry. So what had happened was this young lady shows up to my meeting that night, or the meeting that night, and, you know, we're kind of just chatting beforehand. I'm letting her know what the vision of the group is, what the format is, what we need. And so we have a little bit of time, and I'm like, hey, where are you coming from? She's like, oh, I just came from my parents' house over in Aberdeen. So Aberdeen is probably about 10 minutes up the road. And I'm like, oh, wow. Like, I lived in Aberdeen. I lived a lot of places, so it wasn't really a big deal. But I'm like, oh, I used to live in Aberdeen. It's like, I lived there in first and second grade. So, like, I know. Like, some things I hold on to. And somebody once told me you never ask a woman her age. So I know that you never ask a woman her age. So I'm like, what year did you graduate high school? All right, that was my approach. So she says 1996. I'm like, wow, we went to school together in first and second grade. So, you know, we continue kind of chatting afterwards here and there. And she says to me, you know, I remember there were two Billies in first and second grade with me. And the one moved away in second grade. He was a little bit taller. And now that I think about it, he used to always pull my hair, and I think I had a resentment with him. So I then remembered, being in grammar school, and I remember for whatever reason I had this thing with, like, French braids. So my wife used to always wear French braids. So whenever I would see it, I would just tug on it. I didn't know who she was. I would just go up and just pull on her hair. And here we are. We both show up for service in Alcoholics Anonymous. We start chatting, and, you know, we then date. I mean, by some act of God, we didn't move in together within 3 days. We dated, and then, you know, I talked to my sponsor when I felt like I might want to propose to her. I actually bought her a ring. I didn't just ask over the years. Like, I would just say, yeah, she's my fiance, which she never knew she was my fiance. But with this one, like, we actually, you know, and then we got married, and we had, you know, many people from Alcoholics Anonymous at our wedding. One of the thoughts that I had in early sobriety, and I had voiced it to one of the old timers. I'm like, how am I ever going to get married? Like, what am I going to do at my wedding? And, like, at this point, he just looks at me. He's like, do you even have a girlfriend? You know, and that's how we roll, right? Like, we just think of everything. Like, what am I going to do? And, you know, by way of this 12-step process, you know, I had a wedding, and we had an open bar at our wedding, and I was in no way, shape, or form. Like, I was present for my wedding. You know, and I was there with the people at my wedding, and I was there with my wife, and it was a powerful experience, and, you know, God all the way, right? And, you know, we end up having our son. My little boy Liam is 2.5 years old now, and I was just watching him before I left, and he's, like, spinning. Like, he does this thing where he just spins and makes himself dizzy, and he falls down and crashes into everything. And I'm like, see, Liam, that's why we tell you not to spin, because you fall and you get hurt. And he just immediately starts spinning again. I'm like, yeah, that's clearly my boy. On December 25th, Christmas Day of this year, we had our second son, our little boy Charlie. So he's actually 3 months old today. You know, and I can tell you that I absolutely could not be a husband. I couldn't be a father without without this design for living in no way, shape, or form. Because I can tell you with this design for living, it can be challenging. You know, I would love to say I've been rendered selfless. That would be a lie. You know, through the eyes of my children, I can see how this is a lifelong journey. I can see that, wow, I still get frustrated. Sometimes it disturbs me, like, wow, like I am nearly 10 years sober and I get frustrated at a 3-month-old, you know, crazy. And I'm just being completely honest with you. I love those boys like I've never loved anything in my life, you know, and it just shows me like how much I need this. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has blessed me with so many things. It has given me a life that I never, ever would have imagined, never, ever would have wanted. Right? I did everything to avoid responsibility. I did everything to not live with integrity. You know, I did everything to kind of just live on the fringe of life and be an animal and exist until I died. And today I live. Today I have presence. Today I can be. Today I can be an employee, a worker amongst workers, right? I can sponsor other men. You know, that is... I had a sponsee once say to me, how do you manage to have a relationship with your wife, like sponsoring all these guys? I'm like, no, you're completely getting it wrong. I can have a relationship with my wife because I sponsor all you guys. Left to my own thinking, it can get ugly very quick, you know, left to my own way, left separated from these disciplines, right? Left separated from a lack of prayer, a lack of meditation, a lack of service, I jump right back in the driver's seat, and it doesn't take long for me to hit a tree, I can promise you that, you know, and thank God for the fellowship, the men that I'm accountable to, you know, living, really, truly living in the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12, you know, for that I can show up for life today. You know, I truly believe that I need to stay in the center of this thing. I've watched many people over the years who are given the blessings of sobriety, given the blessings, and they quickly walk away from AA because life is too busy, and I can easily see how that can happen. I hope and pray that it doesn't happen. You know, that's why I am a member of my home group, that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, why I continue to sponsor other people. I've had people say to me, you don't need to sponsor as many people. I let God decide how many people I sponsor. There is no filtering process for me, okay? Because I can guarantee you, what happens is one comes along, I will do my utmost to help them. It may not stick, you know, and it kind of just, it ebbs and flows, you know. But I do need to be active in this at all times, because if I don't, it's a dangerous thing. So I truly thank you guys at Feet First for having me. Congratulations again on your 13 years as a group, and I hope you guys have a blessed 24. Thank you.